Welcome, friends, listeners, and everyone who is fighting for truth, courage, perseverance, discipline, honor, and the other noble virtues that comes to us from the Norse world. In these times of decadence and disintegration, we need to seek the eternal, that which echoes to us through time from our forebears. My name is Henrik. I'm from Sweden. Thank you for tuning in to an independent radio program that is not bowing to any crippling political correctness, nor any master or agenda for that matter. We go where we need to go to understand the world of today, and we are, of course, always honored that you want to spend some of your time with us and learn more about all the amazing revelations that is coming forward to give us a better understanding about why things are the way they are, so that we can do what we need to do to remain who we are and better ourselves. We have a couple of different websites for you: redicecreations.com, redice.radio.net, and redicemembers.com. That's where you can follow our radio program, 3 new shows a week, read our news, see our videos and TV episodes. Our guest today is author Vasilije Lupaș from Romania. He's written several books on King Vlad Tepes, or Dracula, in Romanian, but one of these currently available in English is Dracula, the Engraved Chest of Time, the true story of King Vlad Dracula as told by his royal knights. He is also interested in the fascinating world of ancient warrior cultures and martial arts. He is an 8-times world champion in karate and international martial arts grandmaster. Well, today we'll spend an extended hour speaking about the true story of King Vlad Dracula. Hi, Vasilije. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's great to have you here. Hope you're having a good day in Romania today.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You bet. This is very interesting. We spoke with another guest here previously about not only the story of Dracula. It came up in passing, but we talked a little bit more about the true history of Romania, about the Dacians and the Thracians and Burebista, and a lot of interesting things that have been covered up, actually, consequently, in history. And I wanted to bring you on to clarify a little bit more about the story of Dracula. You have written 2 volumes on him right now, and one of them so far is available in English, and I believe that the second one is about to be translated as well. But before we go into the details about the story, Vasilije, maybe you can tell us why you wanted to write about the story and when you got involved in learning more about this.
Yeah, everything happened when I was a little kid. I don't actually remember how I got this passion for Vlad Dracula. I actually live in his city, where was the capital city of Vlad. So here, kind of everybody loves Vlad, and not only in my city in Târgoviște, but in Romania. And I was very, very much in love with history in general, and he was my favorite character by far. So I went on to the college, I studied history, then my thesis was on Vlad, and I was reading everything that was available about Vlad. And when I kind of read everything, I was keep on asking on the bookstores, do you have everything new, anything new? And they didn't have it, so I said, okay, I'll write something. It was more like, I don't know, it was summer, so I started to write. And people, my friends, told me that they loved it. So I published it, and I had very good reaction, so I kept on going. Now I have 7 books about Vlad. And actually, for the last 3 weeks, I'm translating one for Sweden, for kids.
Oh, really? Great.
Yeah. To tell the story of Vlad, but more like for kids. It's more like an introduction. So this is how I started.
You've done a couple of children's books as well, I believe. That's a great way of doing it, I think, because we talk often on this program about how our kind of European history is very much neglected for some curious reason, and we don't learn that much about it. And I think it's very important to pass down these stories to our children so that they learn more about their heritage and their culture, right?
Sure, in the direction of a country and of a nation, actually. And I think the reason for not studying properly history today, I mean in schools, is because history of, I don't know, Europe or of humankind is history of wars. And now we want to get rid of wars, of course. And maybe it's not good for kids to learn that, I don't know, Romanians fought with the Hungarians the whole history. But I don't think it's a good idea. I think people should know and learn from it and find, how can I say, understanding and harmony between nations from the mistakes of the past. We don't have to hide it. So what I'm doing now, I'm telling the truth in my books when it's about, when it's a children's book. Of course, I'm using a different language, softer and not very hard images and stuff. But still, I believe in telling the truth and learning from it.
Yeah, I mean, war is a reality of European culture, and I'd say any culture, actually, around the world. There's been warring tribes all over the place, but many are told to celebrate their heritage, but for some reason, we are putting the lid on it, which is very unfortunate. I think that if we could look at the reality of it, I think we'd be much better off, you know?
Sure, and even today, like, we have this situation with Russia, which is not very good, and everybody is surprised, like war never existed in our history. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it's very, very strange, very strange. If we keep denying it and keep pretending that it doesn't exist, I think it will prop up again, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, we have to understand what it meant and how much we have to avoid it.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more here then about the true history of King Vlad, Dracula, Wallachia, and the whole background story, and what you think, Vasilia, the people should know about him before we get started here. Maybe you can give us an overview and some of the background to the story.
Sure. When we say Dracula, we're talking actually about two very different characters. We talk about the vampire, which is, I don't know, like Tom and Jerry, invented the myth, whatever. And then we talk about the Christian king, Vlad, who was named Dracula. The connection between them, it's close to zero, actually. It's just the name. What happened in 1897, an Irish author wrote a book, Dracula, okay? But in the beginning, he didn't have a name for the book. And he asked a Hungarian friend of his, who also lived in London, for an exotic name that sounded exotic in Western Europe, in London, in England. And this Hungarian friend, who was very well educated, said, okay, from my area, what about Dracula? I said, okay, sounds perfect. So he took the name and invented a very, very, very different story. And the connection between the true story and the vampire story, as I said, is close to zero. So I think this is the point that we have to start from in our discussion.
So that was Bram Stoker, correct?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Now, have you looked into in more detail about why he did this? Was it just a fiction book? He wanted to write about something exotic, and he just happened to take this story and place it in Romania, in Wallachia?
Sure, because he, as I said, there are also rumors that he didn't actually wrote the story, Dracula. He was kind of stolen from somebody else. And at the beginning, the novel was called Carmela. And probably because the name was kind of similar, he chose Dracula in Transylvania. We have to remember that was 1897. So then distant territories were very, very exotic, very shrouded in mystery. So, yeah, it worked for him then.
So there's nothing here to the story that has to do with either vampires, bats, blood-sucking, or any of that, correct?
No. Well, what is interesting, like, I study in college vampires, the history of them, to see what's happening with them, okay? So almost every culture in the world, almost every, have vampires, which is weird. Like, ancient Egyptians, they have vampires. The Japanese, they have vampires in their mythology, in their folklore, okay? We are one of the only countries, Romania, who does not have vampires, but we are known in the world for vampires, to this novel.
That's
yeah,
funny.
We don't have it. We have something more like zombies in our folklore, but not vampires.
Right.
But now this novel of Bram Stoker, he made us known in the world as Transylvania, the vampire country, which is, I don't know, weird.
Very strange. So this fiction is obviously helping to cover up the real story and the real history.
Not really. I think that it's at this point, it's better known, let's say. But I'm fighting, and some other people are fighting to make the real story better known. Because what happened, Vlad was an extremely important figure for Europe and for the world after all. He saved the entire continent then at 1462. To tell you the story on short, the great Sultan Mehmed the Conqueror, he conquered Constantinople in 1453. And Europe then saw that he's Satan on earth, because he was destroying the Christian capital of Constantinople and so on. His army was great, he was a great general, and almost nobody had the courage to fight him. And he brought into Romania a huge army. Some documents are saying that was 250,000 soldiers, which for that time it's huge. And of course, he was not planning only to conquer Wallachia, Vlad's country, Romania, today. With this army, he was planning to destroy it in 3 days, Romania, and then move on to Hungary, Austria, and then to stop in Rome. And nobody believed that he can be stopped. And Vlad, with his intelligence, he managed to stop Mehmed and send him back to Turkey. So, in that year, he actually saved Europe. And I think this is a story that it's worth knowing.
Yeah, exactly. It's around 1462 here we're talking about. And, of course, if we go forward 200 years, then actually the Islamic armies were at the gates of, Vienna. So he managed for a long time to keep – well, there's several incursions here, of course, and several battles over the prize that is Europe. But let's talk about that a little bit and the battle that was going on at the time and how he managed to – with, I think, relatively few people, a smaller army, keep the Ottoman Empire at bay. How did he do that?
First of all, it was not a conventional war that Vlad was fighting. He realized that he cannot fight an army like Mehmed's. So he was fighting a very psychological war. He knew then that he was called the son of the devil by the Turks. And he used this. He said, okay, if the Turks are afraid of me, let's increase this fear. This is why he's also called the Impaler. He used to impale people. And actually, we have a document from him where he's explaining why he was impaling people, not for sadistic pleasure. He said, if I'm killing an adversary, an enemy, and bury him, I have another one coming, and the new one won't be scared. So I need, with my small army, I need to make a forest of pales, of impaled people, so the other army that is attacking me, to see them and to lose the courage of fighting. And this is what he did, mainly. But also he did many other things. Like, for example, there's a legend here in Romania saying that when the Sultan's army entered Romania, Vlad called 300 of his soldiers, but not the best fighters, but the soldiers with the strongest voices. So they used to make noises, very weird noises, like devil-like noises, on the hills close to the Sultan's camp. And also he took some horses, tied a rope to the horse's tail, and put some hay on it at the end of the rope, and set it on fire. And from the Turkish camp, you see the big balls of fire jumping up and down. You hear the horses that are scared. And you see the 300 soldiers with strong voices making hell-like sounds. So nobody was sleeping in the Turkish camp. But Vlad's army was not attacking. And after a few nights like this, of course, the Sultan's army was very, very tired. Another thing that Vlad did, he burned the whole country, Romania. So the Turks had nothing to eat. They didn't sleep, they didn't eat, and they were always scared. So that army was easy to defeat. And when they get close to Târgoviște, Vlad, we have to go back in time for a second here. Like,
sure.
As a kid, Vlad was a prisoner of the Turks. So he learned the language, and very well, and he learned how they fight. So, back in 1462 now. After 2 weeks, the Turks was close to Trgovište, Vlad's capital. And in that night, Vlad dressed himself as a Turk, went into the Turkish camp, managed to go into the Sultan's tent, and killed the guy there. Unfortunately, the Sultan was changing tents that night because he was scared of Vlad. And after this, he gave a signal, and 7,000 of his men entered the camp dressed as Turks, and everybody was shouting in Turkish, "The Romanians are in the camp, dressed as Turks. They killed the Sultan. Run away. Run back." And the Turks didn't know who's attacking them, who's Turk, who's Romanian. And they fought each other. And we have a Greek document from Vlad's time saying that Vlad and his small army of 7,000 retreated after 2 or 3 hours. But the Turks kept on fighting between them till morning. And 100,000 Turks died that night. So it was very, very intelligent. After that night, the Turks were forced to retreat. Of course, what I'm telling you now is a very, very short version of the whole story.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we could definitely get into more detail here a bit later. But basically what you're explaining so far here is that we're talking about an early version not only of psychological warfare, but also kind of a scorched earth tactic, correct?
Sure. And this was not an invention of Vlad. My ancestor, Vlad's ancestors, used to fight like this from the Romans' time. So it was a tradition here. But Vlad took it to the, I don't know, an extreme level. Because the army that was attacking him was extreme, was the most powerful army of Europe then.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, what do we know? Let's back up in the time here a little bit then and talk a little bit more about his childhood and how he was raised. Well, he was kidnapped, you said, early on to be raised in the Sultan's army?
Not kidnapped. His father was invited there in Edirne, which was the Turkish capital back then, before they conquered Constantinople. His father was invited to sign a treaty, a peace treaty. And he took with him the two kids, Vlad and Radu. Radu was the younger brother of Vlad. But this turned out to be a trap. So they were all put in prison, the two kids and the king. So Vlad had to stay there a few years when he was around 10 or 11. So in these years, he learned Turkish. He learned how to fight as a Turk. He learned how the Turkish are fighting and their strategy. Also, we have many legends about his period spent there. Like one of the legends is saying that Vlad refused at the beginning to train for the Sultan's army. And they beat him up and they forced him. And in the end, he said, "I will train the hawks, the hunting hawks, the birds, for the Sultan." And they said, "Okay, it's a step. Let's start with this." But at the first hunt, they realized that Vlad was training the birds to attack the turban of the Sultan. So they almost took out his eyes. And there are many, many episodes like this about Vlad that shows us that he was very, very strong from the even from the early years.
So the Sultan wanted to kind of raise his children, Vlad and Radu, in their own court as a way of using them against the Romanian or the Wallachians at the time. Is that correct?
Sure, and this actually happened later. Like, when the Sultan came in 1462, he brought Radu, the younger brother that was not actually a brother anymore to Vlad, was an enemy now. Because Vlad escaped from the Turkish court, Radu stayed there. Radu was too young, was 5. And he because he was that young, the Turkish could mold him into actually a Muslim. Not Muslim, sorry, a Turkish leader. So, yeah, this happened in the end. Vlad had to fight his brother, Radu, in the end.
Wow, yeah, what a story. Now, do we have any writings or documents? I think you base a lot of your work, of course, of what the people around Vlad, the court, was talking about at the time. Is that correct?
Sure, but we also have letters written by Vlad, which confirms kind of everything that he said about him. One of the most famous letters is from Vlad to the Hungarian king, talking about the huge army of the Sultan. And Vlad is saying in this letter, "We know there are many, we know they are savage, but we really want to fight them. I will not run. I want to fight them." Like, it's so determined, and so it's exactly 100% what we think now about Vlad and what people around him were saying.
Right. I wanted to ask you about why you think it is that he turned back Vlad and joined his own people again, because other stories tell us that people who are imprisoned or taken by the enemy are kind of mind-controlled. They're not really... They never get that allegiance to their own people again. They get... So what happened there?
Sure. Like, Vlad was 10 or 11 when he was taken prisoner. So we have to understand that times. Like, around 14, young people were going to war already. 14, 17, they were young soldiers. So Vlad was, let's say, old enough and raised with the conviction that he is the son of the king, of a Christian king of Romania. So it was kind of hard for them to mold into changing. Also, we have a very interesting legend that actually is my favorite legend about his childhood. As I told you earlier, they were forcing him to go for war exercises for the Sultan's army. And he refused every day, and then one day, the guardian used a stick to beat him up, to convince him to go to exercises, to training. So the young Vlad tried to block the stick, take it and to strike back. But in the fight, the guardian actually broke his hand. And the legend said that was an open fracture with the bone out and everything. And he went in front of the Sultan, laughing, and said, "You see my bone? I cannot train for you today." And the Sultan was very impressed and asked him, "Okay, I understand, but how come you are not crying?" And Vlad was very surprised and said, "What? The Turkish and the women are crying. At Valachian, no. We never cry." So he was a very, very strong-minded kid. I don't think it was even possible for the Turkish to change him. They managed to change Radu, but not him.
Right. So what age did Vlad come back then to Valachian, and when did he start building up a resistance, an army? Because that's really what happened here. When he came back to Valachia, did the other people recognize, they knew that he was a son of the king, correct? So they knew and were ready to put him in a position of power. Is that correct?
Sure. The story was complicated, let's say. We have some documents, but they're not very clear. And these documents are saying that actually his first kingdom was when he was close to 18. And he was helped by the Turks. Personally, I don't believe in this document. I think it's a mistake of the name in it. But this is a long story and it's too scientific for listeners. But what is sure, Vlad ran from Turkey and escaped to Moldova, which is the other Romanian country. In the past, Romania was divided in three countries, in Transylvania, Valachia, and Moldova. So he was a guest in the Moldavian capital, and there he actually met his cousin, Stefan the Great, who now in Romania he's a saint, and he's probably our most important king ever. But Stefan's father was killed, so they had to run again. So they ran in Transylvania, in the third Romanian country. And Transylvania was run then by... I don't even remember how they say it in English. In Romanian, Iancu de Hunedoara. John... Iancu de Hunedoara, let's say in Romanian. Sorry for this.
Right.
So, and Iancu is one of the greatest knights of Europe, of Middle Ages, recognized everywhere. And so, in my opinion, Iancu had a huge influence in teaching Vlad strategy and war and everything. And in 1456, Iancu with the Hungarian army had to go to Belgrade to defend it, because Mahomet was attacking Belgrade. And Iancu made Vlad the guardian of south of Transylvania, which is the gate to Hungary. So he gave him an army. But that year, after defeating the Sultan, Yanku died of plague. So Vlad was kind of released of his word of defending south of Transylvania. The Sultan was retreating, so there was no danger. And with this army, he went back to conquer his throne, his father's throne, let's say.
Yeah.
And in Romania, we had two families always fighting for the throne. And the country was split in two. And probably more than half of the population was supporting Vlad and his family. And they were happy to have that family back in Târgoviște, back in power. He was then around 24, 25.
I see. So, that's a pretty young age, of course. Well, maybe not back then. People didn't live as long. But you had, what is it? You have the house of Bogdan Musat, and then you had, I think that's where Stefan came from, if I'm
sure,
correct.
Sure. Yeah, well, Bogdan was Stefan's father.
Yeah. Okay, great. Now, so there's a power grab, of course, at the time, so there's a lot of internal fight as well. But maybe we can talk a little bit more about the war itself and some of the intricacies of this. I don't know too much about it. Again, I've seen Hollywood movies about this, which is usually, of course, not very very accurate. But how did Vlad defeat this army? Let's talk about the warfare and the strategies he used and how long of a period the war was going on.
Yeah, the Turks was almost never attacking in the winter. They was attacking in the spring because they needed grass for the horses and, of course, food for the soldiers. So, as I said earlier, Vlad burned all the grass, destroyed all the villages. He basically destroyed his own country, so the invaders had nothing to eat. And this was already a huge blow for the Turkish army. Every day and every night, Vlad was launching very short attacks on the Turkish army. Kind of hit-and-run strategy. And not having food forced the Turks to send small groups of soldiers to look around for food. And every single group of soldiers in search for food was captured by Vlad's people and impaled like 2 kilometers in front of the army. And when they were reaching that point, they were seeing the Turks impaled. And this was, of course, very, very disturbing for the Turkish soldiers. And some of them start running back. And the Sultan had to stop them. Then, you have to remember we talk about 1462. Romania was covered by forests almost everywhere. And as the Turkish army was forcing forward, Romanian soldiers were appearing in the forest very close to the Turks, not showing fear. And this made the Turks attack them into the forest. But before that, Vlad kind of created some corridors in the forest. Not very obvious. But these corridors, they were blocked with some logs. So the Turks could not turn back after entering the forest. And again, every single Turk that was killed then was impaled. And in the day when Mahomed, the Sultan, reached Târgoviște, Vlad's capital, the documents are talking about the forest of pales. Some people are saying that there were 50,000 Turks impaled there in front of the city of Vlad. And then the Sultan stopped and he said, words that are famous now for us, I cannot take the country of this man who knows better than anybody to use his army and our mind to scare us. Yeah. And this happened like from May, and the fights took till October or November, even more long after the Sultan retreated. But he left some small armies to fight Vlad. And the noblemen from Romania then, as I said, they were always choosing between two families. And it was very hard to follow Vlad for them because they were saying the Sultan is way too strong. We defeated the Sultan once, but he'll come back, so it's better to make peace with him. And Radu, the brother, said, okay, if I'll be king, it will be peace between us and the Turks. So this kind of made it easy for the nobleman to betray Vlad. And this is how Vlad lost the war, actually.
Oh, yeah.
He defeated the Sultan, but he lost the war.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and kind of sad.
Yeah, very sad, exactly. So do you think at the time he wasn't seen as a hero? Was there ever a time where he was kind of forgotten about, as you know, in Romanian history?
No, actually he was seen as a hero, but that they had to choose between war that was killing their sons, led by a hero, or peace with a traitor, let's say. So
yeah.
They chose peace. And about the name, Dracul, we have to talk a little about this if you don't mind.
Sure, yeah.
Like, Dracul in Romanian means the devil. So, of course, one might think that a person called the devil, it's evil, no? Makes sense. But it's not. His father was inducted into the Order of the Dragon.
Yes.
Which is a Christian order to fight the Turks. And, again, we don't have dragons in our mythology. We have other creatures. And when the people of Romania saw the insignia of the dragon, they called the father the devil, but they loved the father and they loved Vlad. And this is something very interesting. Pope Pius II, who lived in Vlad's time, he wrote something about the name, this name. And he thought it's a mistake. It's not Dracul, but it's Dragul with G, which in Romanian means the loved one.
Oh, really?
And actually, yeah, actually the Pope wrote this. People in Romania love him so much that they call him Dragul. So it was known then that people loved him and the father.
Wow, interesting story. I did not know that. I did know about the Order of the Dragon, though. And it's interesting, of course, that a Christian order did take such a name, considering how how the dragon is associated in the Bible, you know?
Yeah. There was a dragon holding a cross. It's very interesting. It's a long story. Long story and very interesting. Actually, in December, last December, I've been to Vatican, because we're talking about the Pope now. And the Pope then sent an envoy to meet Vlad when Vlad was a prisoner in Hungary. So after the war against the Sultan, Vlad was imprisoned in Hungary. We'll talk about this in a few minutes.
Yeah.
And the Pope sent an envoy there to see what happened, because Vlad was the Christian hero who defeated the Sultan. Why is he in prison? And what actually happened? And that monk, bishop actually, he wrote a book after meeting Vlad. Like, he met Vlad face to face. And now I managed to bring a copy of that manuscript in Romania, and we're in the process of translating. And it's very interesting because it can be, let's say, an interview with Vlad. And we have the manuscript for the first time now. And I'm actually very, very anxious to have the translation.
Wow. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, the documents?
But I don't really know, because it's not translated.
Ah, okay.
All I know is we have in Romania a version of this book brought in the country in 1966 by a huge Romanian historian.
Yeah.
But it's a printed copy brought from, if I know correctly, from Poland. But even that book was not translated so far. So I don't know too many things. All I know from that old version is that this bishop described Vlad as a physical description, which is very interesting. He said that he was strong as two people. His muscles were huge and he was a very, very powerful presence. And I hope, like, in, I don't know, 2 months or something, I'll have the translation done.
Wow. Well, that's then, fascinating. Yeah, it's always interesting to peer closer into history in such a way and getting, you know, testimonies. And when these stories and myths, really, well, there aren't myths per se, but they've become as such. But it's very interesting when we get some of these testimonies, so that these characters stand out in the from the fog of history, as it were, and we can see them a little bit more clearly, right?
Yeah, and it's a very interesting character. It's not only the truth, which is worth knowing anyway, but it's a very interesting character. Actually, I sold my book to a production house in Hollywood, and hopefully it will happen. And that will be actually the most efficient way to promote real Vlad Dracula. Because if you talk on the radio, if I'm writing books, if you make posters, it's not they don't have the same power as a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, unfortunately not. I know what you're talking
about.
And they've done, of course, a huge Hollywood have done a huge disservice, not only to this story, but to other European stories. And one thing that always kind of bothered me, I don't know what your opinion on this is, Vasilije, but we haven't really had a lot of the European stories lifted out in Hollywood. Not that we should expect someone else to do that for us, but I'm a bit surprised that, let's say, Romanian people or even business people or other Europeans have come together and tried to start something, which is a production company, a production house, a movie studio, what have you, to tell the magnificent European stories that we have about our kings, about our past and our history. We haven't really seen that yet, and I'm very surprised about that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like you said, I don't know how come this never happened, because everybody is angry that, okay, they changed our history, they showed this and this, but nobody's doing nothing.
Exactly.
I don't know. And about being angry with Hollywood, got tired of being angry with them. So maybe it's a good thing after all. Because, like, I have my book in English, okay? And I have many, many people calling me from all over the world, England, New Zealand. I have people from New Zealand coming all the way to visit Vlad's city. And they all tell me the same thing. They said, okay, I started with the vampires, and I loved them when I was a teenager. And now I'm a grown-up person. So, of course, I'm interested in... When I heard that it's a real king called Dracula, I wanted to know more. So maybe Hollywood is doing us a favor in his own way.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bram Stoker and those people, they started the myth, and hopefully people will continue to scratch on that surface. They will get to the real story underneath it.
Yeah, like, as I told you, I sold my book in Hollywood, and hopefully in the next 2-3 years we'll have a movie. And my only condition was no vampires.
Right.
Tell the story.
We'll see about that.
I didn't talk about money. I didn't talk about anything else.
Yeah.
I said, okay, everything you put there, I'll sign. But no vampires.
Yeah, be careful. I've heard about a lot of people who, of course, are very tremendously disappointed. They talk with Hollywood and they agree on certain things, and then it turns out into a completely different project that they had in mind. So hopefully that's not going to happen with your work, you know?
Yeah, the way I see it, like, they are way too strong now, okay? So if it's a step forward, I'll be okay with it. I don't expect them to do my book exactly how it is, with all the characters, with all the facts. I don't expect them, because maybe the target is different. You are interested in history, I am, and everybody who's listening to this show now, it is, but they also have to sell. They think selling, not promoting history.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
So we have to deal with this in an intelligent way, to use it for promoting the truth, after all.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Now let's talk a little bit more then about some of the tactics and the impaling and things like this. That it's I guess a necessary evil to a certain extent that was done at the time. I think us today, we can have the luxury of looking at people in our past, in the European Middle Ages and both before and after that, and somehow sit on our high horse and say, well, what brutes, or there were such barbarians, etc., blah, blah, blah. But the reality of the situation is that they were, of course, faced with true annihilation, extermination in some cases, conversion, complete subjugation to other empires. And I think that we lack the perspective of appreciating the type of sacrifices that they made at the time, and even the horrible choices and decisions to be able to preserve Romania. If things had, if Vlad hadn't been there, maybe Romania as we know it today. Well, I know Romania is a new name, of course, on the country, but the people, the culture and everything might just have been a paragraph in history today as opposed to a real people still alive, you know?
I'm sure of this. I'm sure of this because, as I said earlier, the biggest army of Europe then attacked us. So they didn't come here to justify blood. They came here to erase this country from the face of the earth. And there's another, we have to understand the period then. As you said, now we're relaxed. But maybe, a student of mine actually told me this, and I thought it's very intelligent. He said, maybe in 300 years from now, we'll never kill animals anymore. And we learn in history that 300 years ago in 2015, people were killing little ducklings. And in the future, they find this unacceptable. So we have to understand the period. Yeah, everybody was killing then. This was the human nature. And when the Turks attacked Romania, the army was led by the Sultan. And this was a symbol then. The Sultan was not really coming to war unless he wanted to completely take over the country that he was attacking. So the Sultan's presence confirmed us that they were planning to destroy Romania completely, to turn it into a Turkish territory. So yeah, Vlad was very, very important, and he changed the course of history completely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, of course, a very strategic position behind going into Asia at the east. You have below, of course, Turkey. Do you know anything about how the Ottoman Empire expanded into, let's say, Bulgaria? I think that some territories there were also considered under some of the kingdoms that we've been talking about here, not Wallachia, perhaps, but there's other countries there, like Serbia, you have Macedonia, and then Greece a little bit further down. Were these also consumed by the Ottoman Empire at the time?
Sure, they were not independent then. And look, even today we have some Muslims in ex-Yugoslavia. It seems then. Like between us, Bulgaria and Serbia, there's the Danube River between Romania and these countries, okay?
Yeah.
So the Turks conquered everything up to the Danube River. So we're at the border with them, and we're the only country left then to fight them, which was very important, because if Vlad's country was collapsing, Transylvania, Moldova, and Hungary was collapsing too. So we're like a shield here for them. And it's not too much to say that Vlad actually influenced the whole history of Europe. Because we have to remember all the time that the Sultan came here with 250,000 soldiers and he was going to Rome.
Yeah.
Vlad managed to stop him. But another story about impaling, let's say, before the war. Vlad became known as the impaler in his own country first. And Romania was then the only country that, at least that I know, where nobody was stealing anything. Because what Vlad did, he said, if I'm impaling the thief who stole one coin, okay, the whole village or city will be terrified. If I just, I don't know, give him a fine or kill him and bury him, nothing will happen. We have more and more thieves.
Yeah.
And we have a very sensitive story here, okay? Vlad killed all the beggars, which now sounds terrible, sounds not Christian. But what happened actually, in his first day of kingdom reign, he called everybody who cannot support himself to his palace. He said, everybody who wants to work, but they don't have land, they don't know any trade, come to me. I'll give you land from my land, from the king's land, okay? And I'll send you to learn something, to make a living. But the legend said that only one man came, and he had a wound in his head. He was a soldier, and he was wounded, and he could not remember anything. So Vlad gave him land and actually made him a personal guard of his. And he asked, there's nobody poor in my country anymore? And I said, no, nobody came. But he saw beggars on the street. So the next Sunday, he called all the beggars. And he set a table for them, a huge meal, feast, locked the doors, and put the cannons on that, was a barn actually. And he killed them all.
Mm-hmm.
But then he explained, because now, again, this sounds terrible. He explained something. If you don't want to work, if you don't want to build, if you don't want to support yourself, you have to make a living. Okay? You have to live, to eat. And when the Turkish spies are coming, if they give a golden coin to these beggars, they will say everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And my country is under siege. The Sultan wants to destroy my country. I cannot afford to have people betraying me in my yard. So he considered the beggars, and he was right, kind of spies. And he killed them.
Yeah, a security risk. People who betray and people who can be bought. I definitely understand that completely. It's a strategy. It's a very fierce one. It's tough love would probably be a very soft term on that. But nonetheless, I mean, I think due to the circumstances that he faced at the time, I think many of his tactics were justified, Vasily. And I think as well that we should see Vlad today as one of the saviors of Europe.
Sure, no doubt about this. And we have to remember, talking about this episode with the beggars, first, he tried to give them work. So he was not a sadist, as we see them today, not at all.
He gave them an option.
He tried to give them an option. And he was doing this all the time. He was actually, he had a weird kind of humor. There's another famous story, which is true and documented and everything. When the Turkish envoys came to Târgoviște, and for the first time in history, they asked for 300 Romanian children, to be taken in Turkey and become janissaries, soldiers. The Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, was taking children from the occupied territories as Bulgaria and Serbia, okay? Christian children, as you said earlier, brainwashed, turned into soldiers. And for the first time, in Vlad's time, they asked from Romania for these children. And Vlad knew what they want to ask. So he said, before you start speaking, take off your turbans. And they said, you are raised in our court. You know that we are not allowed by our religion to take off the turbans. And if you continue with these demands, you will make the Sultan very angry. And this is not good for you. So Vlad pretended to be scared, but in a funny way. He said, okay, I'll do something to make sure that your turbans will never come off. And please send my apologies to the Sultan. So he took nails and hammer and put nails through the turbans into the heads and killed the envoys. And he said, okay, you cannot come to my country and ask for my kids.
Yeah.
This is not even the animals are doing this.
Yeah.
And he was always saying, you killed yourself. I received you. I gave you food and shelter. And you ask for my children. You killed yourself, not me.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I definitely understand that. Now, do you think it would be too, if we move forward a little bit here in our history, would it be going too far to say that the war in the Balkans in the early 90s was kind of an echo of some of the incursions that we've seen of Islam into Europe and some of the kind of religious cultural conflicts?
No, this is actually what it is. It's exactly, and it's not the way I see it. It's not about Islam and Christianity. It's about mixing two religions together anyway in the world, unfortunately. All the religions are about love, but when you mix them, when you have too close cooperation with different religions, usually you have conflict. And for sure, this is an echo of what happened then.
Well, this is something that's happening now all over Europe, right?
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And imagine, because we're talking now about how important was Vlad in Europe's destiny. Imagine having a Romanian country now of Muslim religion. We are 20 million people in the heart of Europe. Would be a very, very different Europe. I'm not saying better or worse, but very different Europe. And Vlad stopped this.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. I think people should keep that in mind because we're meddling with things here that we don't understand. I think if we don't learn from history and realize the conflicts that have arisen due to these kind of when cultures are forced together in this way, either by warfare or displacement due to warfare, I think we're extremely naive in these times when we think that these conflicts have just disappeared overnight. I mean, we see there's been plenty of riots in various European countries that are distinctly on the basis of, sometimes ethnicity, but definitely that there is a religious kind of undertone and a difference here between people. I'm not very positive and very encouraged by seeing what is happening right now in Europe. I don't know what your take on that is.
Yeah, I think it's more religion than ethnicity. Because talking about the Pope earlier, I just remember I was very shocked 3 years ago when I discovered a document written about the Pope to the Sultan in Vlad's time, saying that you should become a Catholic and together we have to go to destroy the Orthodox. Which Orthodox and Catholics are both Christian, okay? For me, it was very shocking. But you see, there are conflicts inside the same religion.
Of course, yeah.
This was always a shock to me because personally, I have very good friends, Buddhists, Muslims, Christians. I don't see the problem. It's about love, after all. But this is happening. This is history, and we have to be careful of the lessons that this history is teaching us.
Yeah. You're right. Is there any other writings or documents or letters from the Sultan's perspective at this time?
Sure. Now, for the last 5 years, I'm studying the Turkish documents, which are very, very interesting, because they're admitting what sometimes even the Romanian historians are denying. They're admitting that Vlad won, but they have a very, very particular way of presenting history. They're not saying, for example, Vlad's army came and attacked us. No, they say the black wings of bad luck were upon us, something. So you have to really know history from different documents to understand what that document it's about. It's a little harder. But also we have, which is very good, documents from the Italian countries. They had colonies, and they have merchants in the Ottoman Empire, and they're recording history, not really taking part in the war. And these are, for me, the best documents. And they're all talking about Vlad's victory.
Is there anything else that you can tell us about Vlad that we haven't talked about, something important? I mean, you've written two volumes, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the books here later, but anything else, interesting tidbits or interesting perspectives that you think our audience should know about?
Sure. What happened after the war? So Vlad destroyed the huge Ottoman Empire, okay? And the Pope raised money before the war to help Vlad, to make a crusade, okay? And the tradition was that all this money was coming to the Hungarian king because he was Catholic. And Vlad was Orthodox, so the Pope was sending to a Catholic king, of course, the money. The Hungarian king then was an extremely political and probably the greatest Hungarian king ever, also who had Romanian blood. And Europe was stunned because this king never helped Vlad. Vlad sent him letters saying, okay, I destroyed the Ottoman Empire. I just need you to come over the mountains in Romania and we'll destroy the whole empire. We'll put an end of this terror of Europe. But the Hungarian help never came, although they had the money and the army ready. And seeing that the help is not coming, Vlad himself crossed the mountains into Transylvania, where the Hungarian king was waiting, went to his ally, the Hungarian king, saying, okay, let's do this. Let's put an end to the Ottoman Empire. And then something very weird happened. The Hungarian king arrested him and sent him to prison for 12 years. Nobody understood this. Nobody understood what, why. You're supposed to be allies. Vlad already won. The Turks were very easy to be defeated, like for good then. But what happened? And many Romanians are furious with this Hungarian king, but I cannot blame him actually. Because in his country, in Hungary, many of the noblemen didn't want him to be the king. Also because he has Romanian blood. And he could not leave Hungary because the Austrian king was waiting for an opportunity to invade Hungary, and he was invited there by some of the Hungarian noblemen. So if the Hungarian king was helping Vlad by coming in Romania with his army, he would have lost his own country. So he could not cross the mountains to help Vlad. It was actually, after all, an act of treason for Christianity and for Vlad. But this is history. And that's why I was telling you earlier that the Pope sent an envoy when Vlad was in prison to see what actually happened there. Mm-hmm. Where are the money that Europe kind of raised to fight the Turks?
Hmm. Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Vlad stayed in prison for 12 years. But then,
12 years?
After
12
years. Yeah, and the official explanation of the Hungarian king was that he intercepted the letter of Vlad to the Sultan saying that I'm sorry for our conflict. I want to make peace with you and I want us to attack together Hungary. Of course, this letter is a lie because Vlad already destroyed the Turkish army. So there was no point in seeking the peace with the Turks. Mm. And the confirmation that this letter was invented is that after 12 years, the same Hungarian king who put him in prison, released him, gave him an army, sent him back to Romania to be the king, because he said, I need a strong ally and the strongest anti-Ottoman fighter is Vlad. So he basically admitted that 12 years earlier he lied about Vlad seeking peace with the Sultan.
Ah, yeah. And what was the main reason for this, do you think?
First of all, because he could not leave Hungary, because the Austrian was ready to invade Hungary. And second, he didn't have the money anymore, because the money that the Pope raised for the war. Because he spent it on his own wedding.
Ah.
And he could not admit this in front of the Pope or Europe. So he said, okay, Vlad betrayed.
Oh,
and
boy.
We have many documents from many sources confirming that Vlad did not betray Christianity. He actually just destroyed the Ottoman army.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, our history is a long string of intrigue and drama and, of course, betrayal and everything else. And this story is no different. I think the story is a very interesting case of not only knowing your enemy, particularly as one being part of the enemy themselves and being raised by them, learning their language and ways how they fight and everything else. It's a very, it's kind of a not only guerrilla warfare and pitched warfare that they used later on, but it's kind of one of those scenarios where you're dragged into the court of your enemy and then eventually you turn against them. I think in terms of leadership, though, not that the scenario is similar today as what they faced back then, but I think it says something about leadership, and I think that I've said this many times before on this program that in Europe overall we lack leadership that are truly interested in the welfare of the people as opposed to their own self-interest. And this is something that we're so unaccustomed to in our times that we've developed a kind of a disdain for leadership, which I think it's unfortunate. Europe has had a long tradition of righteous kings and people who are looking after their people, and we haven't had that in such a long time. I think it's a big shame.
Yeah, it requires sacrifice, and it requires a deep understanding of human nature, and it's also something that is changed since Vlad time. What is interesting on this topic, Vlad Dracula is considered to be the first victim of the press.
Right.
The newspapers, let's
yep.
say. Because in his time, the Germans invented the printing machine. And Vlad had a conflict with the Germans in Transylvania, which they started, by the way. So they wrote and they printed stories about Vlad, extremely ridiculous, exaggerated. Like, to give an example, they said Dracula killed 50,000 people in Târgoviște, in the capital city where I live. But Târgoviște didn't have 50,000 people then. So, obvious for even for children out there, they are not true. But because they are printed for the first time, these stories were going around way faster and in wider territories. And the novelty of it made that these stories about Vlad to be known all over Europe. And all these lies about him made him like the master that we think he was. So, talking about leadership, I think this has something to do with it, with not wanting to fight. Because many leaders today, okay, they are attacked by the press that invents all kind of weird stuff about them. And it's sickening at one point. Because I'm fighting for my people, okay? But you say that I'm, I don't know, a thief or whatever.
Yeah. Mm.
And people jump into conclusions. They say, okay, I want to believe this. Okay, I told you he's a thief. So it's, times are changed, and it's very hard to sacrifice now for people who, some of them hate you because they read in a newspaper that you are bad.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. It's something that separates people from true leadership, especially if we look at how the press kind of verbatim treats some of the more pro-European parties, for example. It's very interesting to watch this. It's a very one-sided debate, and we've talked about many times about that on this program, that you know, we have a very small clique at the center of those who are in control of the news and pull the strings of most politicians, I think, anyway. And I think what we need, the reason why I like to talk about a story like Vlad, and some of these other European histories, is because I think it can teach us something about our times today, and something about, just as you said, about sacrifice, about taking those difficult decisions to get ourselves out of a situation. And I'm not seeing that type of sacrifice from the point of view of the leadership at all today in our world. So I hope that, you know, I know that there's a lot of animosity and has been a lot of conflict between Europeans, for example, but I hope that we can, between us together, you know, put down these conflicts and to a certain extent lay them behind us and you know, no more between European brothers and sisters. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's exactly how it is, but it's, as I said, it's hard to have that type of leadership, if you ask me. That type of leaders. Because also, people are not following them. And we're, how can I say, too willing to discuss everything. We discuss good and evil now. I was invited in Romania and other countries to talk about Vlad in conferences, okay? And they were saying, yeah, but maybe it's not that bad. So what if the Ottoman Empire was conquering your country? What do you mean, so what?
Right.
What do you mean, so what?
Yeah, exactly.
They're asking for our children to send them to war. Sometimes war against us.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's debatable. It's not. Some things are good, some things are bad.
I agree. Yeah.
Of course, many, many things are debatable. Like, okay, you like red, I like orange. Doesn't bother me. But when you say about taking the children from a family, a normal family, the peaceful family, and brainwash them and send them to war? No, this is wrong. Let's not debate this. But now people are too accustomed to talk about everything and debate everything. So, I don't know. It's weird because you cannot go back in time. But my opinion, which you might not agree with, is we didn't learn democracy properly. We still think like we're allowed to offend, we're allowed to lie. No, these are not rights. This is something wrong. But some people just abuse it.
Well, I see what you're saying. We're in a time of moral relativism. Like there is no good, there is no evil. We're overanalyzing everything and bicker about the smallest details. And to a certain extent, while we do that, while we are busy, bickering about some of these details, our world is radically changing in front of us. And I think that those people who are just looking after their own self-interests are robbing our banks and selling out our resources. Our jobs are going abroad, and it's creating an awful lot of conflict. We're not. As I said before, we're not used to taking a stance anymore and saying, this is what we want, both as a people, but also as a leader. So I think we have a lot to learn. We're not there yet,
No, not at all. And with the press and especially TVs and movies, we are looking for a leader who has charisma now. Not power to work, not willing to sacrifice, but charisma.
Yeah.
And sometimes the true leaders, they simply don't have the appeal. So we're used to dismiss them. Okay, I don't like his face. Next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes we just don't recognize the leaders. Now, times change a lot. And actually, we live in very different worlds. Like, I live in Romania, okay? I'm 40. And I lived in the communist system since I was 15. It's not like I feel the system changed. I feel like I live in a different planet now, not a different country. So we can only imagine how different was in Vlad's time. So before we understand Vlad, we have to understand the times and then judge or, I don't know, be positive or negative about it.
Yeah, speaking of that, before we wrap up here for this time, let me ask you, what's your opinion about the European Union, is that something you are positive as a Romanian about, or are you afraid of where this might go politically?
I think it's a good idea, but applied badly. Because if being in a European Union means forgetting about who you are, I don't agree with this. And if you travel to Europe in the 80s, Rome was very different than Bucharest. Vienna was very different than London, let's say. Now they start to look the same.
Yeah.
Europe starts to lose the heart. And we have the same shops everywhere, the same kind of culture, the same everything. It was a pleasure to meet another culture, to meet French in France, to see the Italians. Now I'm kind of, we're not there yet, but kind of. Everybody's the same.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's bad or good, but it's not as nice as before.
Well, there's no diversity. It's turning into everything is the same. It's a material consumer monoculture, right?
Exactly, and I liked it way more before.
Me too. I agree. The differences, the beautiful differences between the different European people, and I was out traveling with my family when I was about 10 years old, and we went to a lot of different European countries, and I just remember the how great that was, and the experiencing these differences literally over a borderline. You traveled 100 meters and things were completely different.
Exactly,
I like that, and it's going away. It's such a shame,
Yeah, it was Wonderland, and now everything is made in China.
Yeah,
looks the same in Europe, and I don't know. And I think he's going further and further with this. I'm not saying we should stop it. I'm saying we should stop for a second and think about it.
I think we should stop it. I think we're heading down the wrong road, for sure. I've made up my mind about that a long time ago. I think it's going way too fast, and I think people are not thinking about what this loss of these cultural differences mean, and what it will mean in the long run, right?
Yeah, and not only that, we're not teaching history, which is actually the science of who we are, but I see because of this European, how can I say, feeling, at least in Romania, they start to teach history wrong. Like they say, they talk about events that never took place, which it's, I don't know, beyond words. They start inventing things and stuff, and so next generation will learn about a history that never happened, just to cope with an idea of united Europe. I don't think he's right.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, definitely. We'll let our listeners ponder upon some of these questions here. It's always very important and interesting to hear, you know, from different people around Europe and see how they, you know, kind of view the European Union, view the changes of modernity. And I think the majority of people who are honest with themselves, they see this loss of identity and cultural recognition, a kind of people are forgetting their own history. And I think it's very, very detrimental if we forget who we are. It's not going to bode well for the future here. But Vasilia, this has been very interesting. I really enjoyed having you on the program, and I wanted you to leave us a little bit with some of the details about the books, about your websites, and give us some of the details so people know where to go, not only to pick up copies of your books, but if they want to read more about you know, you or wherever it might have some material available. I know that it's not all in English, but people can, of course, use a translation service if they need to. But at least one of the volumes so far is in English. So tell us about how people can get copies of the book.
Yeah, they can get copies from my website, which is legendofvlad.ro from Romania. And, yeah, the first volume is in English. It's the 8th edition already. I'm working on the translation of the second volume, and now I'm working on it's written already in English, children's story about Vlad, where, of course, the language is way softer and the events are presented way, way softer. And this new book for children will be translated into Swedish soon, I hope, like this year. We already started to work with a Swedish friend of mine who's in love with Romania, and he's always visiting here. So she wanted to know more about Vlad, and was actually her idea. Let's translate this and publish it in Sweden.
Great, yeah. The website, of course, legendofvlad.ro. People can find more information there. I think you've written about Bura Bissa as well, as a children's book too, right?
Yeah. I'm writing series of 10 books. It's called the 10 stories that we own to our children. 10 stories that we have to tell our children. And it's about the 10 greatest Romanian kings, but I chose them not for their charisma, let's say again, but for their importance to Europe. Like, Bura Bissa was the one, the Dacian king, who was ready to fight the Roman Empire.
Yeah, exactly.
And all the other kings are, again, important not only for Romania, but for Europe.
Absolutely, very good. Now, I just want to mention the title here then of the book, Dracula, The Engraved Chest of Time, The True Story of King Vlad Dracula as Told by His Royal Knights. And that particular version is available on Amazon.com. I think it's priced pretty high, so it's obviously better to go to your website to get copies of it. But then we have that's the first volume, by the way, and then there's a second volume called Crucified Between Crosses, or Between the Cross, I guess the translation would be. Is that correct?
Between Crosses, yeah. Because we're talking about the Catholic Cross and Orthodox Cross, where he finds himself in the middle of this absurd fight.
All right, very good. Well, thank you so much, Vasily. Keep up the good work, and yeah, maybe we can have you back again in the future when the other books are out in English, and we can continue and we can talk more.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that wraps up our program for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. If you like the program and want to hear more, join us at redicemembers.com and tune in to all our programs, the first and second hour, all our shows back to 2006, almost 1,000 programs here. A lot to enjoy and learn from in our archives. We'll be back with more in just a few days. Alexander Dugin from Russia is up next as we speak about the fourth political theory and the religion of liberalism. We also have E. Michael Jones, Marion Van Court, Daniel Spaulding, Dr. McCullough, Joseph Atwill, Mike Cross, and many more. Stay true and stay focused. We will be back here before you know it. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your encouragement and for your support. Have a great rest of your day or evening.